Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
It's The Wonky Show. Universities UK is proposing some sort of alternative. There's new analysis on teaching and learning and mental health. Universities are being accused of using NDAs to gag student complainants. OFS is out engaging with students, and we're chatting open access with UKRI. It's all coming up.
And one of the things that emerged out of that investigation was this kind of habitual use of NDAs across all kinds of industries, particularly in the case of sexual assault and harassment. And, you know, these are used... And I think this sort of speaks to a common practice that, having been uncovered, people sort of realise.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Jim Dickinson, and here to avoid talking about the reshuffle, because we're recording too early in the week to notice, we have three excellent guests in Spitalfields. Vanessa Wilson is the Chief Exec of the University Alliance. Vanessa, your highlight of the week?
Oh, well, it has to be yesterday. I was up in Birmingham City University with our Research and Innovation Network.
Fantastic. And in Cheltenham, we have writer, speaker and strategic data advisor, Andy Yule. Andy, your highlight of the week, please?
My highlight of the week is the thing I found in the bathroom of a recording studio on Tuesday. I won't try and describe it. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll have seen it. And if you don't follow me on Twitter, I'll just leave it to your imagination.
And in Upton Snodsbury in Worcestershire this week, it's Wonky's editor, Debbie McVittie. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning. My highlight is coming up this evening as I attend the Labour leadership hustings held by the Jewish Labour movement. So it's all going to be quite lively, I imagine.
Excellent stuff. Right, so yes, we start this week with the news that measures used to assess the value of a degree course could be completely overhauled under proposals to government put forward this week by Universities UK. In a major speech on the topic of value in HE, UUK President Julia Buckingham called on government to broaden its definition of value beyond a student's expected future salary. Debbie, what's going on?
Yep, Julia Buckingham, the President of Universities UK, has got into the papers this week with was basically saying that the value of a degree and our understanding of what a degree is worth needs to be larger than what's captured in the longitudinal educational outcomes, which is basically graduate salary and graduate employment outcomes. And the basis for this claim is that students value more things about their degree than their salary outcome. The public at large, you know, it gets value from degrees beyond student salaries. And so Universities UK is planning to produce a new framework in the summer that captures some of these maybe less sort of tangible or less frequently measured ways of thinking about value. So things like the proportion of graduates working in essential public services, the number that are taking positions in sectors and regions with skill shortages, or whether graduates are starting their own businesses and being entrepreneurial and sort of contributing in that way. So that's the concept. And I had the pleasure of being at the Advanced HE Let's Talk Value conference where Julia gave her speech, and it was well received.
And it's the idea that we will get like a kind of a new basket of metrics to put into a mixer and create medals.
Well, this is where it gets a bit murky, because I think the challenge, there's a number of things going on here. One is, you know, UUK is saying we will provide the data and the evidence to help universities make this case. What I don't think is going to happen is that this becomes policy. So this is really about what universities do with that data and the quality of the communications that they use and how they engage with students and their various stakeholders in their regions and beyond on understanding this wider ideas about value. And I think there's a real question here about, well, you know, how that can be done and whether it will have an impact.
Vanessa, you've written on value for money in HE.
I have, for Wonky's Wicked Problems series, yeah. I mean, I think it's got to be welcomed. I think the UK's work on this, it's great that, you know, they're looking to develop a broader framework. I think to a certain degree, we are winning the argument around public sector skills and to a certain degree, the cultural element. My issue is, though, you know, ultimately, is this framework going to answer the Treasury's killer question as to about whether or not they're going to get a return for their investment, particularly when we've got a population demographic boom on the horizon?
Yeah, and Andy, I think, I mean, it's an interesting move, isn't it, given that, you know, Universities UK have spent the best part of 20 years talking about the graduate premium in order to justify fees and now desperately wants us all to talk about something else.
It is a very interesting move, I think it is very clearly a reaction to the extent to which Leo has dominated much of the policy thinking in this space since the data set was first created a couple of years ago. I think this is an enormously important move on the part of UUK, and I fully support it. I'm incredibly concerned with the extent to which Leo dominates the policy discussion, and it's kind of understandable because the Treasury are so interested in how much of the loan is going to get repaid, and Leo gives some really powerful data to support that debate and that argument. And it is time that we need to broaden the argument. So yes, I think, you know, yes, 20 years of talking about the graduate premium is entirely right, but I think it is about time that the sector pushed back a little bit in terms of this relentless focus on that one measure of graduate salary. So this really has to be welcomed and supported.
But I think there's a few different things going on here, isn't there, Andy? Because there are a number of there's a small minority of students that Leo suggests, and I realize the data is not perfect, who are studying in courses where they would, you know, the indications are they would literally have been financially better off if they hadn't gone to HE. And that's the kind of, that's one thing. And then there's this wider conversation about, about how we assess the value of the degree and how we kind of make meaning about what it means to go to university and the kind of the intellectual skills and the kind of development and the impact that you have as a graduate in society. And, you know, I appreciate that the Treasury is questioning, you know, is asking questions about, for example, the return on creative arts qualifications, because that's one space in which, for example, you know, the salaries maybe aren't what you might expect them to be, or things like, you know, youth and community studies or even nursing. You're not getting an enormous graduate premium from that. But I do wonder to what extent in policy terms those things are priced in. You know, we know we have a very flourishing creative arts sector. We know that salaries aren't great in it. We know that our public sector, you know, the salaries are what they are. So there's an extent to which talking about this kind of sort of ineffable ideas about value and social impact, I think it's really welcome in the sense of, you know, these are important dimensions of HE that have perhaps been neglected and people haven't really bothered to measure until they had to. But it does also distract from that quite specific question about these specific courses where the graduates really aren't getting the returns and really what should be done about that.
But that, I guess, depends when you say the graduates aren't getting the return. It depends a lot on what return the graduate wants to see. I mean, I spend a lot of my time hanging around with musicians. None of them go into music to be rich. You know, I mean, there are other motivations. There are other drivers to this, and so there is something about the aspiration about why people go into higher education and do a degree. I think we have to try and broaden the debate simply from one about, you know, what's on your P60.
If I could come in here, I think ultimately, unless we can powerfully convince Treasury that underwriting student loans in the future is in their best interest, you know, they're going to get this return, I think we will lose the argument, and we will see the return of student number caps, or at worst, student choice compromised, or the autonomy of our universities compromised or challenged. So I think we might, as a sector, be facing some very, very difficult decisions here in order to protect student choice and the autonomy of our universities. And I think, you know, we may have to look at things like where Orgo recommended lowering salary thresholds. And that might need to be a space that we go back to, so that ultimately students, as they're deciding their courses, really have to make, you know, have to look into the future, thinking, I have to repay this student loan, therefore I need to think about the choices I'm making. I also think government has also a key role to play in, you know, they've effectively used nudge theory a lot in their policies, and they should be, you know, looking to incentivize or nudge the student into the subjects that they particularly want them to study, and using, you know, incentives to achieve that. What we don't want to see are courses, you know, universities told which courses they can or cannot teach, or students told which courses they can or cannot do.
But I mean you raise an interesting question, Vanessa, I think. So if I think about this from the point of view of me being a taxpayer, is it okay that as long as there's a student that wants to do a course and a university that wants to put it on, and they, you know, scrape, and that provider scrapes onto the OFS register, that my taxpayers' funding is automatically underwriting that course, regardless of whether it will you know, do well economically or whether it's good socially. Is it, shouldn't there be some restrictions? Because there isn't an endless pot of taxpayers' money.
Well, that's the point I'm making with whether or not, you know, ultimately we need to go back to the, you know, does every student need to, you know, enter into that decision knowing they're going to have to repay that loan at some point. So if it's from a taxpayer's point of view, you know that the student is taking that responsibility. I think that will change the dynamic in terms of the kind of information and advice that the student looks into to make that informed decision, knowing that ultimately going to have to pay this loan back. So, you know, the taxpayer then should be relieved at the fact that it is going to be paid back.
I think Julia made quite a useful point at the start of her speech on Tuesday, which she said, you know, the question students are asking at the minute is less about what salary will I get? And, you know, arguably, maybe they should be asking that more. But it's the question they're asking is, how will I be supported in my learning? And I think, the extent to which broadening the debate about value has got to incorporate both that social impact side, but also that, you know, how are students being supported? How are they being engaged to achieve their aspirations? Because ultimately, preparing them for, you know, life and will impact on their salary outcomes as well, and also their overall well-being and health in the future.
But that's a good question, Debbie, isn't it? So if there were, I mean, arguably there are, but if there were metrics that told us whether students were being supported in their learning, is the way to make all of this fair and okay just to tell students which courses offer that kind of support and then let them choose? Or should there be a kind of baseline of standard of support for students in their learning below which someone can't pull down the subsidy?
But this is where this whole value question gets really gnarly, because you've got NSS results that by and large at an aggregate level say students are pretty happy, they're satisfied, they're getting what they need in terms of their learning. And at the same time, you've got, you know, 60% of students consistently saying in the HEPI Advanced HE survey that they don't feel like they're getting value for money. You've got kind of rising concerns about student mental health. You've got, you know, news stories about, you know, students with a wheelchair sitting at the back of lecture theatres. And it's really hard to know what's actually going on. And I think it's kind of exploring that value gap. And really getting into it with students. I mean, we'll probably talk about this later a bit with student engagement, is where it's, if the question is, you know, how do students feel like they're getting value for money, then it's exploring that gap that is going to answer that question. Should OFS be weighing in and regulating on it? Probably not yet, because I think this idea of value for money still needs an awful lot of unpacking. But there's a sense in which if the NSS data and the perception of value is mismatched, we need to understand what that's about.
Great, yes. So let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, my name is Claudia Zwar, and I'm a senior consultant at NAS Group, which is a public sector consulting firm specialising in higher education. My and my colleague Simon Lancaster's article in Wonky this week is about how universities can respond strategically to the climate emergency. The context for this is the growing body of universities declaring climate emergencies and writing climate change action plans and strategies, which is really important work, but it risks falling apart in a policy environment that incentivises growth that tends to be carbon intensive. And it throws up challenges for universities, like how can they reconcile their internationalisation strategies with the need to fly people all around the world? Or how do they approach the issue of the carbon cost of lots of international students? We think the answer is to incorporate environmental objectives into institutional strategies to make sure that these objectives are part of high-level strategic decision-making. And that helps universities to make the trade-off between all the great things they deliver with the carbon cost and their environmental agenda.
Now, next up, students with few or no helpful teachers are 146% more likely to report a high level of dissatisfaction with life. That's one of the findings in a new policy note from HEPI, authored by Tim Blackman, VC at the OU and formerly from Middlesex, who's applied sophisticated statistical techniques to a recent survey. Vanessa, fill us in.
Yeah, so this item relates to student mental well-being and mental health and the contributing or underlying factors to a student's assessment of their mental health and well-being. Yeah, HEPI, Advanced HE and Opens VC Professor Tim Blackman have all contributed research and thinking in this space. In terms of the key contributing underlying factors identified, teaching quality is a key contributing factor to a student's well-being. Also, there's ethnic identity and socio-demographic background. So, for example, students from the lowest participation quintile experience higher dissatisfaction with life compared with those students from the highest participation quintile. Also, other factors include whether a student is residential or commuter. So, in summary, the study shines a light on the true drivers around student well-being and mental health and the importance of investing in high-quality teaching.
Andy, it's interesting this, isn't it? Because it's very tempting to read a causation, but it might just be a correlation.
Oh, yes. And you know, I think this work has a long way to go yet. I think this is a very significant step in helping us understand some of these issues. I think it's a remarkably good piece of analysis, and I applaud Professor Blackman for it. But like any good analysis, what it does is it doesn't initially provide you with shiny, well-formed answers. What it does do is it focuses your attention on the areas where we should be digging deeper and asking more questions. So I think it is a really good step. But you're absolutely right. You know, there's a lot more to understand in this space.
Debbie, I say that, and Andy's right, of course. But I mean, it's presumably not as if poor mental health could be causing poor support for students. So it's a reasonable guess that there's a causational link, isn't there?
Oof, not going to speak to data. it's one of those moments, isn't it, where it sort of rings true and you sort of think, okay, well, this is absolutely worth asking more questions about. So I think what's interesting about this is this isn't really about teaching quality in the kind of way that it's typically conceived, in that this is about teachers' attitudes and behaviours. So the kind of idea of being helpful and supportive. And it is, you know, it is so interesting to think about the way that teaching staff build the relationships with students, because inevitably certain sorts of students, certain kind of, you know, things like shared cultural background, shared kind of, you know, behaviours and habits and expectations are going to foster a kind of deeper relationship. And of course, and as a consequence, those students are more likely to experience those teaching staff as being helpful. So I think that there's a really interesting thing about cultures and about intercultural competency. And I think it makes absolute sense. I also think that it could actually be true that if students are experiencing stress and anxiety, their behaviours are going to present in such a way as it might present to teachers in such a way as they might be seen as being withdrawn, as being disengaged, and that would lead that teacher to kind of respond to them in a certain way. So this speaks very much to the kind of quality of the relationships between teaching staff and students. But then kind of underpinning that, I think it's not fair to say, oh, well, if teachers are being unhelpful, then that's a problem with the teachers. I think there's probably also a resourcing issue here about the numbers of students that teachers are expected to have a relationship with and the scale of the workload. Because I think, you know, this is an emotional burden, and there's probably gender issues going on here as well, which would be really interesting to unpack. And of course, that should be recognised and as part of a teacher's workload.
And that's interesting, isn't it, Vanessa? So, I mean, you put up the kind of spirited defence of, you know, not reintroducing number controls, which lots of people do. But arguably, one of the things that's happened since we've taken number controls off is there's been much choppier kind of ups and downs in student recruitment within departments and subjects in universities. And I can think of plenty where, you know, there's arguably been over-recruitment and then a shortage of people to do things like marking and support students directly.
I mean, for me, it's more about embracing that kind of more diverse community, actually. And I think it's how you make that whole student community feel welcome, and you're kind of positively embracing the diversity of it. And I can only really speak about my members who, you know, traditionally, you know, the community, the student community is extremely diverse, and the things that they do to make sure that those students are as welcomed as possible, you know, high proportion from state school and disadvantaged backgrounds, commuter students, part-time, etc.
And that's an interesting question, isn't it, Andy? So, I mean, one of the things that has definitely happened in January is that lots and lots of universities have recruited a significant number of international students. It looks like their visa changes are having a positive effect, but I wonder whether universities are fully planned for that kind of diversity and the sort of support they need to put in place to manage it well.
Yeah, and that raises all sorts of issues, doesn't it? Not only in terms of the support that those students need and the different types of support those students need, but also, you know, the impact then on the student body as a whole and how that feels for the other students. So I think yes, there's all sorts of issues within that.
And Debbie, the other thing I was thinking that is interesting is that obviously in theory universities don't have data sets around, you know, mental health and where they might need to do targeting. But if there are relationships between what are in truth some quite specific NSS questions and mental well-being, that in theory allows universities to kind of interrogate which student characteristics or academic subjects where they need to target mental health support.
Yes, but I think, and you know, and I know that you're not guilty of this, Jim, but I think the place to start is with the student reps and with student societies and with, you know, unpacking some of that lived experience, because you know, the data I think gives you a really useful starting point to say, well, here are some questions that we maybe should be asking, and particularly if you've got you know, if you've got statistics on who's visiting counselling services, but also you've got that sort of anecdotal conversational insight coming from student reps about where the issues are and who's coming to the SU with problems, then you can begin to kind of stitch together a picture. And that's where I think the magic happens, when you're kind of working alongside with students to really get a grip of how, and it's not about saying, you know, teachers are behaving like this and this is wrong and this is bad customer service. This is about saying the relationship is not strong enough here to help the student feel supported. And there might be legitimate reasons for that, but they need to be addressed and you know, engaged with in a way that has, you know, respect for this that student's lived experience.
There is a question I would love to see answered in this whole area. I fear the data probably doesn't exist to address it, but, you know, over the last couple of decades we have seen a huge change in the way higher education is funded and you know, the emergence of the tuition fee and the idea that young people will graduate with a colossal debt around their neck. And you know, I would love to see some good long time series data to see, you know, the kind of effect that perception of pressure has on students going through the system, knowing that they're going to come out with this huge debt, and what that is doing in terms of their anxiety in terms of their mental health. I fear the data probably doesn't exist to do that, but, you know, it would be a data set I would love to have a play with.
It's one of those things though, isn't it? It's, you know, if you asked a graduate and said you would really have to think about the question, because I'm sure lots of people will or have asked graduates, do you feel that the burden of debt is contributing to your overall anxiety? And of course the answer to that question is yes, I do. You know, it's hard to know how you would ask that question in a way that would give you that wouldn't, you know, kind of create the problem you're trying to address.
Yeah. Are you strapped for cash in your 20s?
Do you feel burdened by debt? Yes, actually, now that you mention it.
Yeah. Now, one of the real benefits of bringing disparate research funders together under the auspices of UKRI is the idea of harmonised policies. Right now, institutions have to comply with different requirements from different funding councils, and the consensus is turning to the idea that this is needless complexity. There have been efforts to bring policy on open access together before. The RCUK open access policy was a 2013 attempt, and it was revised as recently as 2018. So does the new UKRI consultation point to a continuation or a sea change? DK had a chat to Sir Duncan Wingham at UKRI to find out more.
The new policy applies to all articles accepted for publication by the 1st of January 2021 that acknowledge funding from UKRI and its constituent councils. There's no embargo period permitted. If you've been following the debates around European Plan S initiatives, you'll recognise many of the suggestions, so this is a proper consultative exercise that includes the possibility to advocate for some ideas that are not compliant. Duncan Wingham told me that these draw on extensive pre-consultation. For example, the possibility of more restrictive licensing than the standard Creative Commons attribution option for certain publication is well outside of both the letter and spirit of Plan S, but is a response to pre-consultation issues. I was surprised to see no coverage of supporting materials. Research data, which does feature in the 2013 policy, is another area where differing funder policies cause complex and expensive problems. Wingham suggested that the side of the open science debate would most likely feature in a separate policy. The big change is the inclusion of open access requirements for monographs and book chapters, a huge difference for the humanities and social sciences, which is slated to come into force by the 1st of January 2024. Though the publishing world is beginning to offer this kind of publication option, it's not yet quite mainstream. Perhaps for this reason, we see a 12-month embargo period permitted, a later starting date, and more flexibility around no derivatives licensing. UCRI, of course, includes Research England, and there's a clear read across from some of these ideas in the consultation to what we might expect to see in the rules for the next ref but one. Duncan Wingham suggested that the rules should be compatible, but that it was possible that ref could have more permissive policies than those for directly UCRI-funded projects. This kind of makes sense. There are a lot of other research funders, and although major ones like Wellcome are either on a par with or slightly ahead of UCRI policy on open access, other funders may have requirements that are incompatible. One of the eye-catching ideas suggested in the consultation is a national research repository. Other funders, and indeed UCRI constituent councils, already run open access repositories, as do universities themselves. A national repository would be a serious infrastructure project and would need serious long-term investment.
Hello, it's Jim from the team. The Secret Life of Students 2020. It's our student experience conference where we'll be doing student experience differently. 19th of March, London, Mermaid Centre. You've got to be there. It's all about doing the student experience differently. We're going to bring together research and intel and review everything we learned about students in 2019 and ask what that means for government and regulators and universities and their students' unions. It's about getting beyond the stale debates and case studies and rethinking the student experience, bringing together experts and sector leaders and managers, as well as student leaders and student union managers, to forge a new agenda for students. What does that mean? Well, we'll look at what the new government and the associated regulatory agenda mean for students. We'll take a look at what major changes to funding, the TEF and the National Student Survey could mean for universities and their student unions. If Generation Z is a generation that treasures fairness, we'll think about how we can respond to strengthen students' rights, how teaching and learning could be changing to adapt to 2020's busy students, and we'll have a think about what student influence and partnership mean in a world of big data. We'll also ask how we might get beyond the reductive, endless circular debates on free speech and build a culture of democratic engagement on campus. We'll find out what happens when you listen to students on their own terms, and we'll explore what safety means to students and what safeguarding really means. It's going to be great, an essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. To find out more, you want wonky.com/events, where you'll find details of speakers and details of how to get your ticket. Now, next up then, UK universities are using gagging clauses to stop students from going public with complaints of sexual assault, bullying and poor teaching. Nearly a third of universities have used NDAs for student grievances, and Chris Skidmore tweeted to say that this is nothing short of an abuse of power. Andy, tell us more.
So this is a piece of research that the BBC news team has undertaken. They've used FOI requests. They have got responses from 136 universities, and they have established that around 300 students have signed NDAs over the past 3 years. They have got some numbers around payouts, and the payouts associated with this are in the region of £250 to up to £40,000. The average figure is around £4,500. Yes, Jim, as you say, there has been some virtual table thumping on Twitter from the possibly former higher education minister Chris Skidmore, saying this is not good enough, and this story is causing a bit of a stir. There is the headlines are kind of focusing on issues around sexual assault, although as you rightly say in the introduction, it is around sexual assault, bullying, poor teaching, any kind of student complaint in that space. There are a number of very, very juicy headlines in this. And I think, you know, we need to do a lot more, digging beneath the surface to understand what the issues are here. But on the face of it, it does look to be a potentially very worrying picture.
Well, yeah, I was going to, take quite a reflective, position on this, and to not to jump to the knee jerk reactionary position that governments and regulators tend to do when they're faced with what ultimately is a media story, fueled by FOI and a classic tactic at that. So I do think there needs to be more research and understanding conducted to really understand what sits behind these stories and figures. I'm no expert. I'm no legal expert. It's obviously NDAs are a legal contract that they're used in a number of sectors, probably justifiably in some cases. So I'd really want to understand whether there has been genuine misuse and abuse of them, because I think to jump to the sort of knee-jerk position to ban them and condemn them, I think there could be some unintended consequences long-term if that was taken. I think there does need to be a proper investigation here to understand what really sits behind it. I think having experience in other lives where similar issues have come about, when you are faced with the reality of what's actually happened, it gives you quite a different picture.
Debbie, obviously we heard a couple of weeks ago that the government was considering banning NDAs in an employment context, but DfE's quote seemed to suggest the other day that that might be extended into this kind of student complaint space.
Well, there's a much larger social context here, and it's all really traceable back to Harvey Weinstein. It's a brilliant book out at the minute, which is the journalist who uncovered from the New York Times, who uncovered the Harvey Weinstein kind of long tail of sexual abuse and bullying and harassment kind of throughout a whole career. And one of the things that emerged out of that investigation was this kind of habitual use of NDAs across all kinds of industries, particularly in the case of sexual assault and harassment. And these are used. And I think this sort of speaks to a common practice that, having been uncovered, people sort of realise is incredibly problematic, because, of course, the thing about sexual harassment and assault is that the people who do it tend to do it lots and tend to do it systematically. And by gagging the people who have suffered the abuse, you prevent that kind of that sort of systemic issues from coming to light. That said, one of the kind of things that people say about use of NDAs, especially in the case of sexual harassment and assault, is that, one of the often the kind of the complexities of the case are such that the victims really just want to move on. It is claimed, I don't know with what justification, that, it is, rather than kind of having this kind of public difficult thing dogging you as a victim of assault or harassment, that you're able to just move on. You've got some money to kind of get you started in the next thing, and that you can put it behind you, and that's a kind of good outcome for everyone. I, obviously can't speak to the specifics of the cases in these universities. But I think this speaks to a kind of collective social realization that NDAs are just not appropriate, and they may be kind of legally watertight and they may be kind of legal, but they're 100% not a good way to root out cultural issues, and therefore the world is moving on, and universities will too.
Now it's time for Yes But Does It Correlate? Here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes But Does It Correlate, the podcast segment recently appointed as Minister for Higher Education Data. This time it's a question of area. Do providers with more students as FTEs have more internal space to teach them all? We're looking at all levels and mode of delivery, and the measurements of internal space come from the HESA Estates dataset. FTE and floor space, yes, but does it correlate? And a bonus question, which is the only UK HEI that returns HESA data that has only one building?
I'm liking the picture of all the students at a university sort of standing on the university, all kind of squeezed in and all sort of standing there going, oh, it's a bit tight breathing. I'm going to go with no, it doesn't correlate. And I think that particularly in the case of the Open University, it correlates not even slightly, but also for most universities.
Yeah, I'd say the same. I don't think it would correlate.
I think there must be a correlation. A university with 1,000 students is almost certainly going to be a lot smaller than a university with 20,000 students. But I suspect it is quite a weak correlation.
And the answer is yes, R squared is 0.68, suggesting a clear relationship between floor space and student numbers. The University of Manchester has the most buildings, that's 219 across 7 sites, but the only single building HESA returning HEI is the Royal Northern College of Music. As usual, where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
And finally, the Office for Students has set out a new approach to ensuring that students help shape the regulation of HE in England. The student engagement strategy has been developed in partnership with students from a variety of different backgrounds and with the support of OFS's student panel. Debbie, is this a thing?
Well, yeah, so this is the long-awaited OFS student engagement strategy, and there's some good debate on the site about this morning, where you can kind of go and see what people think. Things to say about it. This is about engagement with the Office for Students. So this is not about setting expectations of student engagement with providers, which some might say is perhaps more important. But this is, this is the the parameters that OFS have chosen to set. I think although there are things to criticise about the strategy, there is also progress to be acknowledged here. So it is good to see that some acknowledgement of formal student representation systems and students' unions and NUS in the strategy, because I don't think 2 years ago OFS would have done that. They were pretty suspicious of students' unions, if memory serves. So I think that does mark a shift. I also think this marks a real shift from the days of Hefke. And, you know, when Hefke was appointed student champion, it sort of led to 18 months of kind of complete panic as they kind of try and figure out what on earth that meant and how they were going to actually listen to student voices. So you know, this is a step forward. That said, there's a sort of shallowness, I think, at the heart of this strategy, and it's a bit sort of troubling for, I guess, anyone who's kind of been professionally engaged in thinking about researching or practicing student engagement. And I think what captures it for me is this sort of old chestnut that students are expert in their own experience, on which this whole sort of strategy hangs, the concept that the strategy hangs on. And I think if you unpack that, it doesn't really mean very much, because I think the thing about student engagement, and if students are going to be able to understand the constituent parts of the systems and the cultures and policies that produce their experience in a university, they actually need an awful lot of education and support to do that, because if they're going to be really meaningfully critical about those systems and processes and cultures, then they need support and engagement and kind of meaningful dialogue. And people who work in student engagement understand that, and that's why student unions invest so much effort and time and thinking in these practices and universities too. So simply doing a survey and kind of getting students in as interns and you know, making sure that you're doing student workshops to ask students about what they think. All of these things are not bad things to do, but they don't really answer the question about how students are going to impactfully and meaningfully shape the regulatory system. And so I think there's more work to do here.
And Andy, it's a bit late to be shaping the regulatory system, isn't it? Because it's kind of already there.
Well, it's already there in terms of, you know, the basic elements, the scaffolding of it, but there is something about how it is used and how it is steered over the years ahead. And so I'm quite comfortable with the idea that actually, you know, these are still very early days for the OFS. It is still the start of their journey, and so I don't think it is a bit late for that.
Vanessa, one of the things that the strategy says they're going to pilot in the next year is encouraging students and students' unions to use the notifications process to OFS, the kind of the snitching hotline. How will providers respond to that?
Well, and before I answer that, perhaps can I just say that my response to this is why only now, and why wasn't this really the first thing that the OFS did, given the clue is in the name. And I think actually, had they started off by really engaging students as part of their regulatory role, then they would be in a far more sort of genuinely more powerful position in the sector as a result. To answer your question, I think is that the right way to go about things? I think if you're really properly engaging the student voice in how you operate and where you focus your priorities, is this what you're really wanting people to do, is to snitch on their providers? I think if you genuinely get the channels engagement right, I don't actually think you need to sort of activate that way of doing things.
And that is one of the kind of interesting aspects, isn't it, Debbie? That obviously the strategy talks a lot about involving students in kind of policy and project development, but that thing about involving students in regulation is actually a lot harder.
Yes. Well, I think it's actually pretty hard to engage students in policy and project development as well. I mean, there is this sort of sense the bit where OFS says, oh, well, we're going to have student-facing communications, and, you know, the heart just sort of sinks, because you just think, oh, goodness, this is going to be cheesy at best, you know. But because if you turn students into kind of a policing function in universities, you do some sort of quite difficult things, I think, to the relationship. And I think student unions have to really think about their, because the demands on student unions, because it's going to be the student union, isn't it? It's not, you know, it might be some random particularly engaged student, maybe probably a PhD student who's actually read the regulatory framework and has thoughts, you know, in a few cases, but it's mostly going to be student unions. And student unions are going to have to think really carefully about where they position themselves, because they want to work in partnership with their institutions. They want to maintain those relationships. You know, that's the right thing to do. They also need to be critical, and they need to be independent. And they need to have their own voice and their own kind of authentic voice of students, you know, as representative as they possibly can be. And, you know, that's a line that student unions always sort of struggle to walk and have to think quite carefully about. The other thing, of course, is they get their part of the thing that they get also get pulled into sort of operational stuff. So not only are they kind of, you know, saying to institutions, you need to tighten up on your feedback and assessment, but they're being kind of told, well, how should we do that? You must bring us solutions and you must bring us ideas, you know. So there's quite a burden on them. I can see the value of a regulator that is open to listening to the voices of students where there is a significant issue, where there is, you know, all kind of internal avenues have been exhausted. And they're kind of bringing that sort of collective voice of, this is a real problem here and it needs addressing, and we've got no one else to talk to about this. But, you know, yes, the idea that students should be kind of running off to the regulator at the kind of first sign of trouble, I think is it's just not going to happen. it's super problematic. And even if it were the right thing to do, I don't see students' unions kind of, you know, just losing that relationship that they built up with their universities that they have to work really hard on in order to, you know, score a point. I just don't see it happening.
Good, so that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you'll find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Vanessa, Andy, Debbie, everyone at Team Wonky for making it all happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.